Blog Talk Radio.
Life is 10% what happens to you and 90% how you react to it. Hey, let's react to the Goldstein on Gelt show.
You're listening to the Goldstein on Gelt show with financial expert Douglas Goldstein. This show is designed to give general information related to investing and finance. Neither Doug Goldstein, his guests, nor the radio station are rendering legal, tax, insurance, or specific financial advice. If you require such advice, contact a competent professional advisor. Before making any investment decisions based on what you heard during the show, please review the complete disclaimer located at www.goldsteinongelt.com. And now, here's your host, Money Maven, Doug Goldstein.
Hey everyone, this is Doug Goldstein. Thanks so much for joining me today. I recently gave a seminar, and I just want to tell you a few things that came up in that seminar. The seminar was actually given in Jerusalem at the AACI. It's the Organization for Americans and Canadians in Israel. And a lot of the information that I covered, it turns out, is important for anyone living outside the United States. One of the things I spoke about, or the main topic, was if you're living outside the United States and you want to have a U.S. brokerage account, what do you need to know? It turns out that because really after 9/11 and the passing of the Patriot Act in the United States, it became much harder for people to do any sort of financial business with the United States, whether you wanted to open a bank account or own a mutual fund or even just wire money from here to there. It was very, very, very difficult. And the what ended up happening, and we see it even to this day, is people want to open an account and they call up a brokerage firm and the firm says, no, sorry, we cannot handle your account. And it also happens that, this happens I see all the time, people get a letter or a call from their brokerage firm in America and they say, because you no longer have a U.S. address, we will no longer be able to properly service your account. And sometimes they'll tell you, the only option you have is to sell out your securities and leave, or they'll give you a few kind of limited options. But frankly, it's terrible. People I know have had relationships with brokerage firms for decades, and all of a sudden they get kicked out. We have a solution, but the seminar, I really spoke to people about a number of the facts that they need to know. So what I'll do for those of you who couldn't make it to the seminar is I want to tell you a few of the points, but I need to take a break for a sec, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about opening a U.S. brokerage account when you live outside the United States. The first thing I want to say before you listen to what's coming up is that if you're a bad guy and you're looking to open a U.S. brokerage account for the purpose of money laundering or funding terrorism or something like that, switch to a different channel. Don't want you listening to this because I certainly don't want to help anyone to do anything like that. The problem is innocent people, normal retirees who want U.S. brokerage accounts, often get grouped into the same list of people who are not allowed to do business with the United States simply because they live outside the United States. So let me give you a few steps that you need to know. And again, these are things that I brought up in the seminar recently. These few steps should help you if you want to have a U.S. brokerage relationship. And there are many benefits to it. I'm not going to go into the benefits right now. I want to give you the how-to. Maybe later we'll talk about the benefits. The number one thing you have to do is you have to contact a U.S. brokerage firm that specifically focuses on people outside the United States. Now, this applies to someone who is both a U.S. citizen and a non-U.S. citizen. If you are an NRA or a green card holder, no problem. You can still own a U.S. brokerage account. You just have to make sure you work with a firm that specializes in that. And not all companies do. This is obviously something that I spend every day doing because my office in Jerusalem opens brokerage accounts and IRA accounts, investment accounts, for people who want them in the United States. But there are others, and so certainly you have to identify the companies that do that. Thinking of identity, that's number two, is you have to be prepared to clearly identify yourself. We're going to ask you for a government-issued passport or your driver's license, something that's a real ID. We're going to take a scan of it to make sure you are who you say you are. And we'll also ask you for an electric bill to confirm that you are, in fact, the address you give us is the address where you live. So we certainly are careful to make sure that the people who we're talking to are who they say they are. And the third thing that we'll do, which is a big step, is we're going to have you sign either a W-8 form or a W-9 form. A W-8 form will be if you are not a U.S. entity, and a W-9 form is someone who is a U.S. person. those two forms are your proper declaration, and then your account gets coded right. Either one is fine, but it's important that you sign the right one. By the way, if you're an American citizen and you live outside the United States, you don't want to sign a W-8 to open your personal brokerage account because that's the wrong form. And I've seen banks, foreign banks, who don't understand, and now they're having people sign these forms. They don't really know which form you should sign. They don't even know how to fill it out. So it's kind of up to you, if you're working with a company that doesn't have experience in this, to make sure the paperwork is correct. We're always very careful to check the citizenship of our clients and to make sure that they sign the right documentation. You know, there's a whole lot more. I guess the seminar I gave went on a lot longer, but I need to bring on my first guest, who I hope you'll enjoy, a fellow named Gary Rivlin, who wrote a book called Broke USA. And he's going to talk to us about government regulations and how to solve a number of the problems that have arisen. He's an investigative journalist. I think you'll enjoy that. And in part two, I'll be speaking to Jason Hartman. I was actually a guest on his show a while back. He's an investment advisor, and he's going to talk to us about leveraging the three areas of our lives to get the most out of it. So stay tuned for that. I'm your host, Doug Goldstein. Thanks so much for joining me. Any questions or any comments, go to goldsteinongelt.com. See you in a minute.
When you feel like your money is flying out the window and your nest egg starts to fry, there's just one show in all you gotta know. Goldstein on Gelt will explain it all to you. Goldstein on Gelt will finally get it through. Personal finance advice like you've never seen before. Interviews, stock tips, and so much more.
Okay, we are back. I'm very happy to have on the Goldstein on Gelt show Gary Rivlin, a best-selling author, recently came out with a book called Broke USA with a very interesting subtitle. Gary, tell us the subtitle of your book.
So, From Pawn Shops to Poverty, Inc., How the Working Poor Became Big Business. So my fascination in 2008 as the global economy was melting down, were all these businesses, pawnbrokers, check cashers in the United States, what we call payday lenders, short-term small loans, $200, $500, but at preposterously high interest rates. I really wanted to look at those businesses as they went into hard times, because conversely, you know, hard times would be good times for them. There's an expression I learned. I spent like 2 years on the economic fringes looking at these different businesses, spending time with some who created really, really big businesses out of that in payday lending, check cashing. And there's an expression I learned: a banker looks for 100 people worth $1 million, but a payday lender, others on the fringes, they're looking for 1 million people, none of whom even have $100 to their name.
So describe what their business model is. What are these payday lenders all about?
So payday lenders, again, it's a couple of $100, depending on the state, they could lend up to $600, $800, and it's a two-week loan. And everyone has a job. You have to have, well, at least they're on some kind of regular government check, Social Security in our country. And so it's a loan against your next paycheck, against your next government check. And, you know, we have usury laws in this country, a cap on interest rates at 15, 20, 30%. But these got an exception. So they're actually charging rates that work out to an annual percentage rate of 400%. Some states in this country, more than 400%. Online, they're charging 700%, 800% interest. And so even though it's such a nickel and dime business, it's a $15 fee here, a $70 fee there, it turns out it's very, very big business.
Let's break that down a little bit more. I just want to understand the business. So they have to a guy comes into their shop and he's getting paid in 2 weeks, and he needs $400 right now. That's the model you're talking about?
Yeah, theoretically, his car broke down. You know, he's got a dentist bill. He just can't make the bill. I mean, we're talking about people who are barely getting by. They have a job, but it's $20,000 a year, $30,000 a year. So they need a short-term fix.
So they need a few $100, right, to cover them for the short term, and this payday loan company is going to somehow get to know this guy. They're going to process the loan. They're going to lend him money. And the risk, what's the risk to the company to lend the money?
That they don't pay it back.
Okay.
So there's no real collateral. There's just so what the customer does is writes a post-dated check. So typically it's a $15 fee for every $100. I mean, again, varies state to state, but that's a typical one. And so you take out $300 and you post-date, you write a check that's post-dated for $345. So the risk is that when that lender goes to cash that check, that there isn't enough money in a bank account to cover it.
Okay.
And, you know, so go ahead.
So I'm not trying to defend. I don't think people should be paying 700%, you know, interest. So I'm not trying to defend that, but I am trying to understand that the payday, the company does have a risk. Obviously, there must be a fair amount of default on these checks, and they do lose money from time to time, or at least have to chase people down to get their money. And because it's
exactly.
a legitimate business, they're not loan sharks. They're not, you know, breaking your kneecaps, are they?
No, they're just calling your work. They're calling your home every day. Some actually visit the home. I mean, you know, and by the way, I'll point out they're not breaking kneecaps, but the typical loan shark in our country is charging what would work out to an annual percentage rate of 150%, 200%. These folks are charging twice that much, if not more. In fact, I actually found a loan shark who just laughed at me and said, "I'm so jealous." I mean, he was a small-time loan shark, but, you know, the fact that a guy in his hometown had taken this idea, he's from Cleveland, Tennessee, where the payday loan was invented in the 1990s by this guy, Alan Jones, he was amazed that this guy just took this idea. Alan Jones brings in $25 million a year after taxes in the payday loan business. So it's a small-time business, $25 fee here, $75 there, but you add it up, he's got 1,300 stores, or at its peak, he had 1,300 stores. And, you know, it is big business.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Gary Rivlin, a best-selling author who wrote a book called Broke USA. He talks about some of the problems that the very, very poor people have and, well, let's say just accessing cash. So I'm getting the sense from our conversation, Gary, that you're not a big fan of these companies. So my two questions are, one, is this something the government should, you know, make illegal or prohibit? And secondly, how should these people get access to cash?
So take the first part first. So these were sold to lawmakers. Again, we have laws in the U.S. against that cap interest rates. Even Adam Smith, you know, the invisible hand, Mr. Laissez-faire, said that for a functioning financial system, you have to have a fair rate of lending. But state by state, their lobbyists went around convincing lawmakers, hey, people are desperate out there. Let's give an exemption for emergency loans. A car breaks down, you can't get to work. You just need for 2 weeks a short-term loan. Big deal if it's $45 for that 2 weeks. You're avoiding $50 in bounced check fees because you're taking out a payday loan. The problem, the flaw in that is that there was a study here a year or two back that showed that 70% of the customers have these loans out for more than half a year. So then it's not for an emergency loan. It's just a very expensive way of balancing your checkbook. I talked to one guy who's a big time payday lender who he left the business, and you know, almost every one of his clients, he told me, hundreds of people per store, almost every one of his clients had these things out all the time. So for the same $500 loan, they're paying $2,000 a year in fees. But with that said, can you outlaw these? Your second question gets to the problem here. There is no good alternative for those living on the margins. In your question, you said the very, very poor. Just one correction that it's not the very, very poor because you need to have some kind of check coming in. So I would call them the working poor in this case because you need to have at least the promise that you'll pay this back. So there's all sorts of products for them. There's another one called the title loan. That's using it's like a pawn shop, but your car title is the loan. That's actually insidious, and that one I would outlaw because you're putting up something very valuable, your car, and you're loaning money against it. Of course, if your car's worth $2,000, they'll lend you $500 towards it because if you default, they're going to take your car. And even though there's a valuable piece of collateral on that loan, and they're charging 200% a year in interest, 300% a year in interest, sometimes more. So that's the problem. It's the rates they're charging.
What's the alternative? I mean, you know, it seems to me as though in a normal free market, and listen, I could probably walk downtown and put up a sign and say, you know, I'll lend you money and I'll only charge you 300%. So there must be a reason why they need to charge these rates, or why the people are willing to go to these shops.
Well, they charge these rates because they could get away with it. I'll throw back at you that, again, even Mr. Invisible Hand, Adam Smith, said it's essential to a functioning financial market that there's some cap on the rates. But I'll point to Florida, which says you can only take out one of these payday loans at a time. We'll limit the number you could take in a year, and we're going to tell you you can't charge more than $10 per hundred, which at least is 250% or so as far as an APR. I talked to a guy from a credit union in North Carolina, a really big credit union, all the teachers, all the state employees. You know, he's charging 12% annual interest for his payday loans, and he calls it the most profitable product he has. And there's a banker in Louisiana.
That's a great example you're giving. So in other words, if he's charging 12%, you know, he's competing against the 700% guys. Why wouldn't more people just go to the 12%?
Well, it's limited. It's not like what's brilliant about the business they built is these are like McDonald's. There's tens of thousands of them. In fact, there are more payday lenders in our country than there are actually McDonald's and Burger Kings combined. They market these things. They're storefronts. They make it so easy. And, you know, in honesty, you know, where payday lending is, I don't know, about a $40 billion a year business in this country, you know, these others, if you add them up, don't add up to $1 billion in payday loans a year. It's so much small time. It's a small service they offer. I just bring it up as proof that the profits that the payday lenders are making are obscene. If the states just took away the exemption to the existing usury laws and let them compete, you would see that instead of the single most profitable product out there, I mean, it's amazing. Subprime credit cards, which I write about in Broke, subprime of any kind, subprime mortgages, they generate two times or three times the profit for the lending institutions. Big.
Oh, presumably there's more risk involved.
Part of like Citibank. No. But what I'm saying is, I mean, the risk is built into that. I mean, yes, 10 or 15% of these default, you lose 10 or 15% of your money through defaults, but that's built in. Even factoring in defaults, I'm saying as a product, the net income, the profits you get at the end of the year from this product, the banks were showing two or three times the profit margin. So instead of making a few percentage points on this product, they're making 8, 10, 15% profit margin on that. Early on in payday, before there are any rules, you know, these folks are making 30-40% profit. That, you know, I wrote about Silicon Valley for a long time. they're jealous of those kind of profit margins in Silicon Valley where they don't make anything at all.
It just seems to me, I don't know, I hear what you're saying, and it sounds, you know, rough for these people who just don't get a good deal. And it's not like, you know, you can go into your bank and get a mortgage for 4 or 5 or 6%, and they just maybe don't have the opportunity to do that. So they're doing these very, very short-term loans. So, Gary, we're just about out of time, but in the last few seconds, I know that there's a lot more you cover in your book. Tell me, how can people follow you, follow your work, and really learn more about what you're talking about?
So I have a website, www.garyrivlin, G-A-R-Y, Rivlin, R-I-V-L-I-N, same as your president, .com. And, you know, I've written about the poverty industry, but also Silicon Valley. I just wrote something about New Orleans after Katrina. So I tend to write on a range of topics.
And that is very true, and it's fascinating. Gary, I really appreciate the time. We're going to put a link to that at the show notes of today's show at GoldsteinOnGelt.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we wrap up the first half of the Goldstein on Geld show, I'd like to follow up on something I was talking about at the beginning of the show before our first interview. I was talking about people who live outside the United States who want to open U.S. brokerage accounts, or let's say an IRA account. The IRA account, by the way, would apply, let's say you worked in the United States and either you had an IRA there, or maybe you had a 401k or a 403b. If these numbers don't mean anything to you, I'll just tell you they are the code names that we have for various types of retirement accounts that people often had through work. You can roll those over into an individual retirement account, an IRA account, and that's something we do all the time for people. Anyway, to open the accounts, I was explaining that you're going to have to work with a firm who deals with people who live overseas. You're going to have to properly identify yourself using a government passport or a driver's license. You're going to have to give us an electric bill so we know who you are. You're going to have to sign the right form, the proper form, to identify who, whether you are a U.S. citizen or not a U.S. citizen. And the last thing I just want to leave you with here is that there are many services that investment companies provide, and you should try to take advantage of both. What do I mean? The services basically are advisory services where someone's there to talk to you about your situation, help you to make smart decisions, hopefully help you to make some money. Of course, none of us can guarantee any results. We're not prophets, but we are there to advise people, and that's part A. And you always want to make sure that the advisor you work with is licensed in the jurisdiction where you're working. So if you have a U.S. brokerage account and at the same time you have you're living in Israel, so your advisor should be licensed in both places. Or if you're French and you're working in France with a U.S. brokerage account, make sure that your advisor is properly licensed to give you advice. And the second thing you need to get is proper clearing and custody. That's a technical term that we use to refer to the back office. Where is your money held? Who prints the statements? Who gives you the checkbook or the Visa or MasterCard? Who puts it all together? They're not advisory companies, but they're major brokerage firms or banks that do the back end, and we call that clearing and custody. And I would strongly encourage you to make sure that whoever you work with, whoever's going to help you along the way, can give you access to both. Otherwise, you're going to be responsible either for getting your own advice or making up your own advice on your own, or you're going to have to open your own brokerage account somewhere. And as we said in the beginning, these days, that's a huge problem. So look for a boutique firm, a specialist firm, that can give you both advice and custody of the account all under one roof. All right, stay tuned. In just a minute, we're going to be going into part two of the show. I'll be bringing on Jason Hartman, an investment advisor, talking to us about interesting ways of leveraging three specific areas of your life. I'm your host, Doug Goldstein. Thanks so much. If you have any questions, check out goldsteinongelt.com and click on the Contact Us button.
You're listening to Money Maven, Doug Goldstein, on the Goldstein on Gelt show. Stay tuned for the second half of the show right after the break.